Now, this evening we're going to be doing a very, very important case, which will have particular relevance to people here in the Silicon Valley. The Santa Clara Valley, as it is officially known, for the benefit of people who are hearing this in other parts of the country, is, as is generally well known, the capital of the American electronics industry. And this area prides itself on its entrepreneurship, its small business wizardry, and it in particular likes to pride itself on its originality. The entrepreneur is king around here. And there is a sort of a mythology here in the Santa Clara Valley about people striking out in their own direction and setting up, doing their own thing, so to speak, and making out very nicely as a result of their creative efforts. Well, on the program this evening, we're going to be taking a look at what happened to an individual who developed a very useful computer software program. And we're going to take a look at what happened not only to that individual, but also to his company, and what happened to an awful lot of other people who got involved with this particular case, the Inslaw case, in one capacity or another. The Inslaw case, the Inslaw is the name of the company, and they had put together a case management software program and sold it to the Department of Justice, whereon the Department of Justice refused to pay Inslaw and then began a systematic effort to use the federal bankruptcy courts to drive Inslaw out of business when they wouldn't sell out to a friend of former U.S. Attorney General Edwin Meese, who had a computer company that wanted to acquire Inslaw's assets and the Promise, P-R-O-M-I-S, software in particular. There may be listeners in the Silicon Valley here or elsewhere who do not think that the subjects that I talk about in this program are ever going to affect them personally, and I would point out tonight's broadcast as a good example of just exactly how they can become personally affected by things of this kind. We're going to begin by taking a look at the first of 10 articles from the Napa Sentinel done by Harry Martin, the driving force behind that biweekly publication in Napa, California. This outlines the Inslaw case in its basics, talks about how Bill Hamilton, the head of the Inslaw case, sold his computer software program, this case management program, which, as we will see, can be adapted to a lot of other uses, sold it to the Department of Justice. And then when he would not, in turn, sell out to a fellow named Earl Bryan, a friend of Ed Meese and an individual with, as we shall see, more connections than a switchboard, we will see that a whole lot of trouble, a whole lot of shaking befell the Inslaw Company and its founder, Bill Hamilton. We're going to take a look at the testimony by a fellow named Anthony Pesciuto, as well as a fellow named Cornelius Blackshear, both affiliated with the federal bankruptcy program, and specifically they were involved with the trusteeship program. Both of them testified that the U.S. Justice Department deliberately undertook to drive the Inslaw Company out of business and into bankruptcy so they could take over its assets, and this in response to Inslaw's refusal to sell out to a friend of Edwin Meese, who was a business competitor of theirs. The company that this fellow founded was called Hadron, H-A-D-R-O-N, his name once again, Earl Bryan. As we shall see, Cornelius Blackshear, the associate of Anthony Pesciuto, later, after having been visited by Justice Department employees, he recanted his testimony. We shall see how a judge named Basin, B-A-S-O-N, I'm not sure how that's pronounced, it may be pronounced otherwise, but he ruled in favor of Inslaw in the case. It should be noted that the U.S. Department of Justice, in a pattern of deliberate obstructionism, which will become quite familiar, refused to cooperate with a Senate subcommittee headed by Sam Nunn, which looked into some of this malfeasance. Should also be noted that Jack Brooks and the House Judiciary Subcommittee are also looking into the Inslaw case. In the second of the articles, the Harry Martin articles from the Napa Sentinel, we're going to take a look at what happened to some of the individuals who obstructed the Justice Department's attempts to pirate both Inslaw and its software, the Promise, P-R-O-M-I-S, software. First of all, we referred earlier to Tony Pesciuto. Well, he was an associate of Cornelius Blackshear, who, after being visited, as I said, by Justice Department employees, recanted his earlier testimony supporting that of Anthony Pesciuto. Pesciuto was offered an opportunity to obtain a long-awaited transfer to Albany, New York. After he obtained this long-awaited transfer, he recanted his earlier testimony. Then his transfer, after he bought a house in the Albany, New York area, Albany is in upstate New York, his transfer was canceled, and he had to commute from Albany to Washington, D.C. Judge Basin, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, was one of only one of four out of 132 bankruptcy judges that was not reappointed. He instead was replaced by a fellow named S. Martin Teel, T-E-E-L, who had previously argued, an attorney who had argued for the Justice Department in the Inslaw case. He replaced Justice Basin. And we will go into, once again, the Hadron Company, headed up by Earl W. Bryan, a friend of Ed Meese, a longtime associate of Ronald Reagan, and Earl Bryan, who also headed up a consortium which purchased United Parcel United Press International, excuse me, UPI, not United Parcel International, United Press International, Earl Bryan's company, Hadron, after Ed Meese became head of the Department of Justice, began receiving lucrative contracts not only from the Department of Justice, but also the Department of Defense and the U.S. Agency for International Development. We're also going to take a look at a fellow named Lowell Jensen, the Deputy Attorney General under Edwin Meese, formerly the fellow who, as Alameda County DA, had prosecuted the Seminese Liberation Army, which we looked at in Radio Free America 23. Lowell Jensen, a fellow implicated in aspects of the Iran-Contra scandal, or the obstruction of the investigation thereof, had previously been a competitor with Inslaw. We're going to take a look at how a U.S. House subcommittee has accused the Department of Justice, and specifically current Attorney General Richard Thornborough, of stonewalling the investigation into the Inslaw case. Thornborough is currently evaluating whether or not he should resign his position as Attorney General and run for the Senate seat of the late Senator John Hines, whose death we discussed a couple of weeks ago on this program. It should also be noted that the handling of Judge Basin's position, where he was one of only four of 132 bankruptcy judges not to be reappointed, he was replaced by a Justice Department counsel who'd argued against Inslaw in the case before Judge Basin. It should be noted that no bankruptcy judge wanted to touch this particular case after Judge Basin did not receive reappointment. So apparently that intimidation worked. In the fourth article that we're going to be looking at about the Inslaw case, we're going to take a look at how the U.S. Department of Justice pirated Inslaw's software, how it was sold to a number of different people, illegally, of course, not only U.S. government agencies, but foreign intelligence agencies as well. We're going to take a look at a Chilean named Carlos Cardoen. I've seen two different spellings, C-A-R-D-O-E-N and C-A-R-D-U-E-N. This was a fellow who was involved in armament sales to Iraq, and among the recipients of the pirated Promise software was Iraq. We're going to take a look at an article from the San Francisco Examiner and Chronicle of a few weeks back. Actually, I think it was back in December, in which a fellow named Jonathan Moyle, a British journalist looking into, among other things, Cardoen's situation in Chile, how his apparent suicide was almost certainly a murder. This in connection with the pirated software, perhaps, or perhaps other aspects of the covert arming of Iraq. Again, Iraq, one of many countries, many foreign countries, in addition to a number of different U.S. agencies, federal agencies, which illegally received the pirated Promise software. We're then going to take a reasonably substantial break, because this broadcast will be quite long this evening. After that, we're going to take a look at a fellow named Michael Riconosciuto. His name is R-I-C-O-N-O-S-C-I-U-D-O. We're going to take a look at Riconosciuto and his involvement in the Inslaw case. Riconosciuto had testified about just exactly what kind of an operation permitted the U.S. government to pirate the Inslaw software. Riconosciuto was involved with a joint Wackenhut Corporation and Cabazon Indians, C-A-B-E-Z-O-N Indians operation, in which the Indio-California Cabazon Indian Reservation, which has a sovereign status, the Cabazon Indians are a sovereign nation, they had been involved with a private intelligence agency and detective firm with the Wackenhut Security Corporation, with manufacturing and distributing a whole bunch of armaments to various countries, and in particular the Nicaraguan Contras were a major recipient of support through this particular project. It was under the auspices of the Cabazon Wackenhut operation that the Inslaw software was pirated and illegally distributed to foreign intelligence agencies and U.S. federal agencies as well. We're going to take a look at what happened to Michael Riconosciuto when he testified to this fact. A fellow named Peter Vidnieks, V-I-D-N-I-E-K-S, an associate of Earl Bryan and a member of the U.S. Department of Justice, basically offered the proverbial carrot and stick to Riconosciuto. He was offered a favorable settlement in a child custody case and a favorable settlement in an investigation of some associates of his in connection with an Orange County savings and loan, and in turn threatened with unfavorable resolutions of those situations if, depending on whether or not he either refused to cooperate with the House subcommittee investigation or whether he insisted on testifying against the Department of Justice on behalf of Inslaw. Ultimately, Reconosciuto did testify, and the threats were made good. He was arrested and held without bail, initially without being charged, and this apparently in connection with the threats that he received. I have received word from Dave, our Napa Sentinel, with a small s, that there may be new developments now breaking in the Inslaw case, and a very tragic development as well. I will perhaps have more information about that for you next week. We're going to take a look at Texas Representative Jack Brooks, not only his stewardship of the House subcommittee investigation of Inslaw, but also his accusation that the U.S. Department of Justice was withholding some 200 documents that they had requested. We're going to take a look at the filing of charges in our sixth article against Michael Reconosciuto. We're also going to take a look at three murders of Cabazon Indians who had objected to the joint Cabazon-Wackenhut operation, which, among other things, appears to have intersected with the Contra support effort. There was an accusation by a sister of one of the victims that much of the pirating of the software was in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal. We're also going to take a look at a man named Hayes in Texas who found some of the pirated Promise software in junked computers. Apparently the pirated software was still available to a certain extent on these machines. By the way, we're also going to take a look at the fact that the Justice Department initially felt, among other things, that the Promise software represented a threat because it could be used to reveal illegal doings within the federal bankruptcy trustee operation. That's an important element because, as we're going to see, that operation is extremely dirty and was used for some very unsavory things. We're also going to take a look at the fact in our seventh article that a Canadian investigation is now underway of the Inslaw case. Two Canadian agencies were also recipients of the illegally pirated Promise software. And we're going to take a look at how a 2020 investigation or program of the murders of the three Cabazon Indians who had objected to the joint Wackenhut Cabazon venture, the CIA was named as a chief suspect in the killer of those three. We're also going to take a look at Canadian speculation that specifically the illegal sale and piracy of the Promise software provided funds that were used for the illegal funding of the Nicaraguan Contra guerrillas. We're also going to take a look at an allegation that Michael Reconosciuto had laundered some $40 million on behalf of the Quail Bush campaign. That's an allegation that comes from only one substantiated source so far. In our eighth article, we're going to take a look at information indicating that former Green Beret, now employed by the Chicago Fire Department, were used in these murders. We'll also look at a connection between some of the elements behind the joint Wackenhut Cabazon operation and the Gambino crime family. We will also take a look at the murders of five more Cabazon Indians, bringing to a total of eight the number of Cabazon Indians murdered, apparently in connection with the joint Wackenhut Cabazon venture. This, the vehicle for not only apparently for generating funds for the Contras and arms for countries around the world, but also specifically the vehicle for the pirating and distribution of the Promise software of Inslaw. We're also going to take a look at what by now is a very familiar pattern, namely pressure that was brought to bear on the Riverside County investigator looking into the Wackenhut Cabazon venture, and specifically the murders on the Cabazon reservation. We're also going to look at an interesting connection that the bagman to bring the money for the murders of the Indians had previously been involved in the overthrow and assassination of Salvador Allende in Chile. In our ninth article, we're going to take a look at an individual who we also examined in connection with our program, our miscellaneous archive series dealing with the CIA connection to the SNL scandal. This is a fellow named G. Wayne Reeder, and specifically we're going to take a look at his associate, Dr. John Nichols, an individual who not only intersects with the CIA connection to the SNL scandal, which we looked at in a past program. He also maintains that he had worked for the CIA in connection with the overthrow of Allende. Interesting in light of the other possible Allende connection, the allegation that the bagman who brought the money to pay for the killing of the three renegade Indians, I guess you could say, at least from the U.S. standpoint, that fellow also apparently connected to the overthrow of Allende. In our 10th and final article, once again, from the Napa Sentinel, We're going to take a look at connections between former CIA Director Admiral Stansfield Turner and the Wackenhut Corporation. We're also going to take a look at an apparently brief uprising by the Cabazon Indians to take back their reservation from the Wackenhut Corporation. This only resulted in an apparent Wackenhut occupation of the reservation. We're going to take a look at some apparently successful threats against the aforementioned Michael Reconosciuto, in which his four-year-old son's life was threatened if he testified on behalf of Inslaw in the House investigation of Inslaw. The House Judiciary Committee was actually threatening to cut off funds, or to move to cut off funds for the Department of Justice if they did not begin cooperating with their investigation of the Inslaw case. We're going to take a look at apparently the successful attempts to intimidate Michael Reconosciuto, because he indicated that he would not testify in order to save the life of his son. We're going to take a look at a fascinating connection which may underlie much of the activity around the Promise software in Inslaw. We're going to take a look at Australian allegations that the Promise software was distributed with an override password which would permit the CIA to access the computer files of other intelligence agencies, including and especially friendly intelligence agencies, something which no doubt sits poorly in the minds of those intelligence agencies. And once again, we will wind up with a look at some of Earl Bryan's other activities. He had formerly been involved with a consortium that purchased United Press International. I believe that UPI has since been sold to another party. So that's a brief rundown of what it is that we're going to be looking at in tonight's broadcast. After another musical break, we're going to be back with the main body of tonight's program. Once again, a miscellaneous archive show called We Have Ways of Making You Sell, the Inslaw Scandal. Music, and then back with the main body of tonight's archive show. Well, good evening. Welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. It's time now to begin this archive program, and once again, the title of this broadcast is We Have Ways of Making You Sell, the Inslaw Scandal. And we will be relying this evening on the printed source which so far has given the best coverage to the Inslaw case. There have been a number of others, but the best coverage so far is coming from the Napa Sentinel, a small biweekly publication that, as I mentioned before, is published in Napa, California, by Harry Martin. And Harry Martin has done this series on the Inslaw case that will be providing the vast bulk of the grist for our mills this evening. Next week, we will take a look at strong intersecting elements between the Inslaw case and the October surprise. But this evening, we're going to focus on the Inslaw case. Now, research credit on all of the Napa Sentinel articles on the Inslaw case goes once again to Dave, our Napa Sentinel with a small s, a listener to this program up in Napa, who has been instrumental in helping to get information from Harry Martin and the Napa Sentinel down here. Now, the very first of the articles on the Inslaw case from the Napa Sentinel is from the Napa Sentinel of March 12th of 1991. This is a front-page story from the Napa Sentinel called Federal Corruption. It's by Harry Martin, and there is an editor's note at the beginning of this. When discussing the widespread corruption in the federal bankruptcy courts, it is difficult to focus on just the Northern California jurisdiction. This new series will focus on the extent of the corruption throughout the nation and its linkage to various courts. Then the article itself begins. When the U.S. government sent Anthony Souza to Northern California to investigate what government officials called the dirtiest system, unquote, in the United States, it was aware that the entire bankruptcy system is unraveling. Former LendVest trustee Charles Duck was the main focal point of Souza's investigation, even though a local bankruptcy judge called him the most honest man, quote, unquote, he had ever known. Duck's ties to bankruptcy judges throughout the Bay Area is providing a picture of intense corruption going deep inside the law community, the bench, and even into the federal law enforcement agencies. Even Souza admits privately that his hands are tied. There has been one known murder in Northern California that has strong possible links to the bankruptcy system. There have been several more in Texas. This series will focus on different incidents from different parts of the country. One of the most bizarre cases of corruption in the bankruptcy system involves a small, Washington-based computer software firm called Inslaw, spelled capital I-N-S-L-A-W. In 1982, the firm signed a three-year contract for $10 million with the U.S. Department of Justice. The software program Inslaw developed was a case management computer program called PROMIS. That's capital P, capital R, capital O, capital M, capital I, capital S. The software, which was developed by Bill Hamilton, enabled the U.S. attorneys to keep track of information on cases, witnesses, and defendants, and to manage their caseloads more effectively. I will interrupt, as we will see later on in this series, the PROMIS software can be adapted for a number of other different uses as well, including military applications. Continuing. Though the U.S. Attorney's Office placed the PROMIS program into operation in several of its offices, it refused to pay Hamilton. Subsequently, Hamilton was forced into the bankruptcy court. Former U.S. Attorney General Elliot Richardson, representing Hamilton, advised him to sue the Justice Department for stealing his software. Anthony Pasciuto, spelled capital P-A-S-C-I-U-T-O, who was the deputy director of the Executive Office for U.S. Trustees, which oversees bankruptcy estates on behalf of the court, had stated that the Justice Department was improperly applying pressure on his office to convert Inslaw's Chapter 11 reorganization into a Chapter 7 liquidation, which would mean that all company assets, including the rights to PROMIS, would be sold at auction. That last couple of sentences again. Anthony Pasciuto, who is the deputy director of the Executive Office for U.S. Trustees, which oversees bankruptcy estates on behalf of the court, had stated that the Justice Department was improperly applying pressure on his office to convert Inslaw's Chapter 11 reorganization into a Chapter 7 liquidation, which would mean that all company assets, including the rights to PROMIS, would be sold at auction. U.S. Trustee Cornelius Blackshear, B-L-A-C-K-S-H-E-A-R, corroborated Pasciuto's story. Two days after he was visited by Justice Department officials, Blackshear issued a sworn affidavit recanting his earlier testimony. Those last two sentences again. U.S. Trustee Cornelius Blackshear corroborated Pasciuto's story. 2 days after he was visited by Justice Department officials, Blackshear issued a sworn affidavit recanting his earlier testimony. The Justice Department recommended that Pasciuto be fired. The memo seeking his dismissal reads, quote, "But for Mr. Pasciuto's highly irresponsible actions, the department would be in a much better litigation posture than it presently finds itself," unquote. Federal Bankruptcy Judge George F. Basin, B-A-S-O-N, Jr., ruled in 1987 that the Justice Department had acted illegally in trying to put Inslaw out of business. Basin sent Edward Meese a letter recommending that he designate an appropriate outside official to review the dispute because of his prima facie evidence of perjury by Justice Department officials. Meese did not respond. Later that year, after nearly 3 weeks of trial, Basin ruled in favor of Inslaw in its suit against the Justice Department. Quote, "The Department of Justice stole Inslaw's software by trickery, fraud, and deceit," unquote, the judge stated, adding, and again quoting, "The Justice Department engaged in an outrageous, deceitful, fraudulent game of cat and mouse, demonstrating contempt for both the law and any principle of fair dealing," unquote. Judge Basin ordered the Justice Department to pay Inslaw $8 million. Basin's verdict was upheld on appeal by U.S. District Court Judge William B. Bryant, B-R-Y-A-N-T. 3 months after Basin's ruling, he was denied reappointment to the bankruptcy court. And we will examine more about that failure to reappoint Basin in the next article. Continuing with this article of Bill Hamilton, the developer of the PROMIS software, Hamilton's trouble began when a friend of Edward Meese attempted to buy out Inslaw, but Hamilton turned him down. In a court document, the potential buyer is quoted as saying, quote, "We have ways of making you sell," unquote. And beginning again, by the way, there's a misprint in the first. Ed Meese is Edwin Meese, not Edward, I believe. I may be wrong about that, but it's printed Edward. I believe that's a misprint. Once again, Hamilton's trouble began when a friend of Meese attempted to buy out Inslaw, but Hamilton turned him down. In a court document, the potential buyer is quoted as saying, quote, "We have ways of making you sell," unquote. It was after that that the trouble for Inslaw began. The Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, chaired by Senator Sam Nunn, began an investigation into the Inslaw case. Once the inquiry got underway, the Senate Judiciary Committee's chief investigator, Ronald LeGrand, capital L-E, capital G-R-A-N-D, received a phone call from an unnamed senior officer at the Justice Department, a person LeGrand has known for years. The caller told LeGrand that the, quote, "Inslaw case was a lot dirtier for the Department of Justice than Watergate had been, both in its breadth and its depth, unquote. The Nunn Committee completed its investigation and published its report. It recognized that Inslaw has been a victim of the system and stated that, quote, the Justice Department had been uncooperative, refusing to allow witnesses to testify without representatives of the litigation division being present to advise them. The effect of their presence was to intimidate those who might otherwise have cooperated with the investigation, unquote. The report states, again quoting, the staff learned through various channels of a number of department employees who desired to speak on the subcommittee, or to the subcommittee, I should say, but who chose not to out of fear for their jobs, unquote. The last sentence again. The report states, quote, the staff learned through various channels of a number of department employees who desired to speak to the subcommittee, but who chose not to out of fear for their jobs, unquote. Congressman Jack Brooks of Texas has opened a new investigation into the Inslaw case. Brooks is investigating allegations that Justice Department officials, including Meese, conspired to force Inslaw into bankruptcy in order to deliver the firm's software to a rival company. The rival firm, according to court records and law enforcement officials, was headed by Earl W. Brian, last name B-R-I-A-N, a former cabinet officer under then-California Governor Ronald Reagan and a longtime friend of several high-ranking Republican officials. Meese had accepted a $15,000 interest-free loan from Brian. Meese's wife was an investor in the rival company. This is the same company that allegedly sought to buy Inslaw from Hamilton and made the alleged threat. What happened to Promise? The Promise is in use throughout the nation and has been used also for military intelligence information. It has the ability to track troop movements. An official of the Israeli government claims Brian sold the Promise program to Iraqi military intelligence at a meeting in Santiago, Chile. Remember the Chilean connection, because we'll be coming back to that. Continuing with the article, the software could have been used in the recent Persian Gulf War to track U.S. and allied troop movements. Ari Ben Manasha, capital B-E-N hyphen capital M-E-N-A-S-H-E, a 12-year veteran of Israeli intelligence, made the statements in a sworn affidavit to the court. Interrupting, remember the name Ari Ben Manasha? We'll be taking a look at him not only in connection with the Inslaw case, but next week we'll be taking a look at him in a big way in connection with the October surprise. Continuing, more about the Promise software. The software is now operative with the CIA, the National Security Agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the U.S. Department of Justice. Only the Justice Department is authorized by the court to use the software. Brian now claims he acquired the property rights to the software and consummated a sale to Israel, although he had allowed its use by the Israeli intelligence forces for as many as 5 years before the actual sale. In essence, a small company in Washington developed a very sensitive computer program with which the Justice Department obtained. The courts ruled in favor of the developer, and the judge who made the ruling was never reappointed. The software was acquired by a friend of Meese, and the Justice Department has never paid for its use and has allowed other agencies the right of its use. The bankruptcy court was a tool, as it appears to be with other jurisdictions, to support the economic gain of a few. Charles Duck was not alone, as the record will prove. Now, summing up briefly the major points of that article, touching on them briefly. In the first place, remember Anthony Pesciuto, a Department of Justice trustee, or his actual title, the Deputy Director of the Executive Office for U.S. Trustees. He initially testified that the Justice Department was illegally persecuting the Inslaw company, and his testimony was backed up by U.S. Trustee Cornelius Blackshear. Well, Blackshear recanted his testimony in a sworn affidavit 2 days after being visited by Justice Department officials. This is a pattern of interference with the investigation of Inslaw, which will hold true and which will include forms of interference from going up to and including murder, as we shall see. Remember Anthony Pesciuto. We're going to see what happens to him later on as well. Remember the name George F. Basin, the bankruptcy court judge who ruled for Inslaw and against the Department of Justice, as we shall see in the next article we're going to look at. He was not reappointed. We'll take a look at who replaced him in that article as well. Bear in mind now that this particular trouble began for Bill Hamilton, who developed the Promise software, when he refused to sell out to a friend of then-Attorney General Edwin Meese. That friend was named Earl W. Brian, last name B-R-I-A-N, a longtime Reagan ally. And bear in mind also that when the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, chaired by Senator Sam Nunn, began an investigation of the Inslaw case, Justice Department employees who sought to cooperate with the investigation were intimidated by having litigation attorneys present, or attorneys from the litigation division of the Department of Justice, and this had the effect of intimidating potential witnesses and people who might have cooperated with the investigation. Bear in mind that the Promise software was sold to other countries, apparently illegally, and has been used by them. Bear in mind also its national security applications. It can be used to track troop movements, as well as the original case management application, which its designer had drawn it up for, or invented it for. And we're going to see now in our second article just exactly how the federal bankruptcy courts are used as a tool for illegal activities. Once again, now, going into the second article we're going to be looking at. By the way, this is actually the third article in this series. The second article, which is also very important but not directly relevant to the Inslaw case, deals with a fellow who wrote a book called Unfriendly Skies. And this was a fellow who had inside information about all sorts of skullduggery vis-a-vis the investigation of airlines and airline crashes in particular. And he received similar treatment to the way Inslaw was handled. We're not going to look at that this evening because that is not directly relevant to the Inslaw case, although part of the same pattern of abuse. The next article that we're going to look at, and once again, research credit on this, as for the rest of these articles, goes to Dave, our Napa Sentinel. This article is from the Napa Sentinel, with a capital S, of March 19th of 1991. Its headline, How the Justice Department Used Bankruptcy Court. And it reads as follows. Actually, skipping down into the article. As a result of the Inslaw cases, many heads in the Justice Department were lopped off. When Judge George Bason, B-A-S-O-N, a bankruptcy court judge, refused to liquidate Inslaw, ruling instead that the Department of Justice used deceit, trickery, and fraud, he was only one of four who were not reappointed to their jobs. A total of 132 were reappointed. Now, bear in mind, once again, the bankruptcy court here is being used to drive Inslaw illegally from a Chapter 11 reorganization into a Chapter 11 or Chapter 7 liquidation, which would have mandated that, among other things, Inslaw's assets, including the much-coveted Promise software, would have been sold at auction. Bear in mind that Judge Bason ruled in favor of Inslaw and against the Department of Justice. He was one of only four bankruptcy court judges who were not reappointed. A total of 132 were reappointed. Continuing with the Napa Sentinel article. But to show the collusion of the Justice Department when it removed Judge Bason from the bench after his ruling against them and for Inslaw, they had S. Martin Teel, T-E-E-L, appointed to the bench to replace Bason. Who was Teel? He was a Department of Justice attorney who unsuccessfully argued the Inslaw case before Judge Bason. Sentences again, because this extraordinary machination here, this replacement of Judge Bason with an attorney who had argued for justice against Inslaw, is only too characteristic of the kinds of things that we will see as we get into these articles, the kinds of successful or otherwise attempts to cover up the Inslaw case. Repeating the last paragraph, but to show the collusion of the Justice Department, when it removed Judge Bason from the bench after his ruling against them and for Inslaw, they had S. Martin Teel appointed to the bench to replace Bason. Who was Teel? He was a Department of Justice attorney who unsuccessfully argued the Inslaw case before Judge Bason. Tony Pesciuto admitted that he was ordered to pressure the bankruptcy judge to rule against Inslaw. Recall, he's the former deputy director of trustees, bankruptcy trustees for the Department of Justice. Now, here his name is spelled Pesciulo, P-A-S-C-I-U-L-O. It's Pesciuto in the first article. I'm not sure which is correct, but Pesciulo prevails, so we'll call him Tony Pesciulo. Tony Pesciulo admitted that he was ordered to pressure the bankruptcy judge to rule against Inslaw. After being subpoenaed by Inslaw's attorney, Pesciulo was offered a long-awaited transfer by the Justice Department from Washington, D.C. to Albany, New York. Pesciulo bought a home in Albany and then changed his testimony. After the testimony was completed, the Justice Department canceled his transfer. Pesciulo had to commute from Albany to Washington. So if Tony Pesciulo, the person who originally resisted the Justice Department pressure on him to pressure the bankruptcy judge to rule against Inslaw, in other words, what we're looking at with Pesciulo is one of the whistleblowers on the case. Repeating again the last couple of sentences, Pesciulo was offered a long-awaited transfer by the Justice Department from Washington, D.C. to Albany, New York. Pesciulo bought a home in Albany and then changed his testimony. After the testimony was completed, the Justice Department canceled his transfer. Pasciullo had to commute from Albany to Washington. Former Attorney General Elliot Richardson made a list of the baffling questions of why the Justice Department wanted Inslaw declared insolvent and why it wouldn't pay a $7 million settlement to the small company. Inslaw received an offer to sell their company, and they refused. The buyer informed the company that he had powerful political influence and, quote, "we have ways of making you sell," unquote. Within 90 days of that threat, the Justice Department commenced its attack on Inslaw. Once again, the last two sentences, because they're the theme and title of the program. The buyer informed the company that he had powerful political influence and, quote, "we have ways of making you sell," unquote. Within 90 days of that threat, the Justice Department commenced its attack on Inslaw. The company that made the attempt to buy Inslaw had financial connections to Meese and some of Meese's cronies. When the battle ended, Inslaw was broke. An attorney, a Justice Department whistleblower, and a judge were out of work. But Inslaw was saved by a corporate giant, IBM, that rescued the company virtually from the auction block. The company that allegedly made the threat was Hadron, or Hadron, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, H-A-D-R-O-N. It has had brushes with the Security Exchange Commission. It has gone to the brink of being broke, and one of its companies has been accused by the SEC of fraud and manipulation of stock prices. The company lost $4.3 million in 1 year. It soon sunk $12 million into the red. But once Meese became Attorney General, Hadron suddenly received lucrative Pentagon contracts along with the Agency for International Development. The company was also awarded a $40 million contract from the Justice Department, despite protests against the bidding process. One member of Hadron's board was Dr. Earl Bryan, who was in Reagan's California cabinet along with Meese. Meese was chief of staff in California. The deputy attorney general was D. Lowell Jensen, capital J-E-N-S-E-N, who had competed against Inslaw years earlier. The person in charge of making Justice Department payments for Inslaw software and who didn't was an employee that had been fired at Inslaw. This last item again. The person in charge of making Justice Department payments for Inslaw software, and who didn't, was an employee that had been fired at Inslaw. Jensen was also in trouble when the Senate was investigating the Iran-Contra scandal. And as we shall see, that the Iran-Contra scandal intersects directly with Inslaw. We'll get to that later. Apparently, the Senate committee discovered a memo written by Jensen to the National Security Council warning that Miami federal prosecutors were on Ollie North's trail. The memo revealed that the Justice Department, who was supposed to prosecute the Iran-Contra affair, actually was tipping off the government in advance. Now, bear in mind Lowell Jensen, because he is one of the connecting links between the Inslaw case and the Iran-Contra scandal, and we'll touch on him again later. Continuing with Harry's article, one Justice Department officer testified at the Inslaw hearing that Inslaw's software could be dangerous. Thomas Stanton, S-T-A-N-T-O-N, testified, quote, "Inslaw could besmirch the U.S. trustee program," unquote. The program is so sophisticated that it could trace all assets, track all trustees and judges. Another Justice Department employee stated that the U.S. trustee program was flagrantly political. Quote, "It was a way of getting cronies into office. There would be 50 or 60 positions to be filled. It was Meese's baby," unquote. The official also stated, quote, "It was always puzzling to me how he got away with doing what he got away with. He'd do things that were blatantly wrong and no one would question him. It's kind of scary." The Meese program would concentrate too much power in one government department. Quote, "It's supposed to act as a watchdog over lawyers and trustees, but the problem is it's more. It has a considerable amount of power to control the administration of cases. When a case moves from bankruptcy to liquidation, the U.S. trustee's office names the trustee who converts the assets, oversees an auction, and retains appraisers who will put a price tag on the leavings. The U.S. trustee's program also links justice and the IRS. The thing that's a little frightening about it is that the U.S. trustee department sees itself as part of the tax-collecting function of government. The Justice Department represents the IRS, and the IRS is often the biggest creditor in liquidation," unquote, states a leading bankruptcy attorney. So the central elements of this article, first of all, the extraordinary maneuvering that takes place in and around people who have attempted to bring the Department of Justice to heel vis-a-vis the Inslaw case. Remember now, Anthony Pasciullo, the deputy director of the U.S. Justice Department's bankruptcy trustee program, he had previously resisted pressure to work on behalf of justice against Inslaw and to pressure the bankruptcy judge for ruling on behalf of justice. He was awarded a long-awaited transfer by the Justice Department from Washington, D.C. to Albany, New York. He then changed his testimony. Then his transfer was canceled, and he still had to commute from Albany all the way back down to Washington, D.C., where he was working again. At least he was working. The bankruptcy judge, the aforementioned George Bason, B-A-S-O-N, was not reappointed to his position as a bankruptcy judge. Only four bankruptcy judges at the time were not reappointed. He was one of them. 132 were reappointed. So he was only one of four out of 136 who was not reappointed. The person who was appointed in his stead was S. Martin Teal, who had been a Department of Justice attorney who had argued on behalf of justice against Inslaw. And this is a pattern of interference and skullduggery that we'll be looking at throughout the course of the program. Recall also the aforementioned Cornelius Blackshear, an associate of Pasciullo's. He had corroborated Pasciullo's testimony, then was visited by Justice Department officials and recanted his testimony in a sworn affidavit 2 days later. Remember also the name of Hadron, H-A-D-R-O-N, a company which was $12 million in the red, but when Edwin Meese, a business associate as well as a political associate of Earl Bryan, a member of the board of directors and a longtime Reagan California a cabinet member, when Hadron was $12 million in the red. When Meese became attorney general, Hadron begins landing lucrative contracts not only from the Pentagon and the U.S. Department of Justice, but also the Agency for International Development, which, as we've looked at in the past, has done a lot of work on behalf of the U.S. intelligence community. Remember the name also, Lowell Jensen, because we'll be coming back to Lowell Jensen. He warned the National Security Council that Miami federal prosecutors were on Ollie North's trail, and he also was a fellow who had competed against Inslaw years earlier. He was deputy attorney general at the time that this all went on. Bear in mind also another important element of this article, the fact that it was believed by people in the Justice Department that the Promise software might expose the skullduggery and the wrongdoing going on inside of the federal bankruptcy trusteeship program because of its sophistication. So Promise, which was sold by Bill Hamilton to the Department of Justice, was actually seen by the Department of Justice as a threat to the sort of corruption and nepotism that we're going to be looking at this evening.